this week on the Inside Flap.
I was once at a BEA, like a big book convention, and I had a signing at the booth. And I was really excited because there was a huge, huge line. And I was like, yes, all these people for me, I'm winning. And it turns out they were all there for the booth next to mine, which was Egg Begley Jr. And he had a book about biodiesel. And I was like, God damn you, Egg Begley Jr.
We get the letter. And the letter is a card that we had like pre-written where all he has to do is write the content. And he crosses out the smiley face on the outside of the card, draws a big frown. And this is the saddest letter. Mom, Dad, I know I said I hated it here last year and want to come home. Well, this year I really mean it.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you guys so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Sitting across the table to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And back in studio in the snack shack, resting comfortably on the floral
wearing
couch.
Wearing Christmas jammies.
Wearing his what is that? Is that a bunch of they're little tiny whales with Santa hats on them, on his flannel?
You know it. Excelsior, or I should say. Ho, ho, ho.
There you go. That is Andrew Dowd.
Mid-July.
Have you back here, Andrew? Yes.
Yeah, so it is mid-July, but we have had unusual weather out here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get home, it was probably like 60 degrees, it's like windy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I changed out of my work clothes, and so, you know, I don't want to put on like, I typically would put on shorts or whatever this time of year. So I figured, you know, the Christmas jammy pants would be the way to go.
Yeah. I wished him a Merry Christmas when I walked in the snack shack.
A quick, let's do a quick weather check. It's 66 degrees. Okay.
No, it's chilly. Right.
Huh.
Yeah.
Feels, some of us have been working all day, so it feels a little warmer to some of us. No, I'm talking about
Dave Medicus.
This guy. Welcome to the show.
The Inside Flap.
This is the Inside Flap Book Podcast. Oh, man, we have a treat for you guys today on the show. This is a guest that Laura and I. This is a guy we've been chasing for a long time. We have been recommending this guy on the podcast ever since we started the show. New York Times bestselling author Grady Hendrix joins us. That deserves
Where's the applause?
Yeah, boy!
Yes, and we'll give him a little more round
polite
of applause.
Applause.
Laura and I, we just had the best conversation with her. Such a funny guy, a nice guy, has some really interesting stories to tell. Absolutely a delight talking to Grady. His new book is called The Final Girl Support Group, and we'll have that conversation for you in just a second. But first, Andrew and I took a little trip downtown Denver. Now, I'm tooling around on Sunday. I'm driving, must have been one of the many trips as I'm driving Sylvia around to this place or that place, dropping her off somewhere here and there. I don't know where.
It's a good thing. Like next year, she's going to have her permit. And now I can see like, oh, that's
her
license.
Well, she's got her
license.
Permit.
Sorry,
yeah, her license. Yeah.
Her license. And now I'm thinking, wait, that's going to be. It's not going to get here soon enough.
It's going to free up an awful lot of time for us. But I'm driving around. I get a text from Andrew, and he says, "You want to go to the Home Run Derby or the All Star Game?" And all of a sudden, I'm like, "Whoa! Yeah, you got my attention." And I gave him a call. I said, "Whoa, what's going on?" And he's like, "Well, you know, it's here in Denver. We got nothing else going on. Let's go to see the Home Run Derby." So we decided that we were going to go see the Home Run Derby. And listen, I've watched for years, and this is a competition they have. They invite 8 Major League Baseball players, some of the most prodigious home run hitters in the game.
It's a book podcast.
Every year, well, they can fast forward past this.
It's fine. Don't. It'll be entertaining.
Every year, you're going to want to hear the end of the
really?
Story. A funny little kicker for you
Okay.
coming up. But every year at the All-Star Game, the night before the All-Star Game, they have the Home Run Derby hitting contest, in which they get 3 minutes each hitter to hit as many home runs as they can. And they go up against, they have like one-on-one competitions.
That's cool.
And it's like an eight-player tournament. So you
in
win
3 minutes, yes, as many as that pitcher can pitch to you and you can hit.
Right. And you have your own coach who throws the ball to you. So you, as a player, get to choose who throws the ball to you. And you go head-to-head against another one. Whoever hits the most home runs in those 3 minutes goes on to the next round. And if you hit a certain number of home runs and if you hit a certain distance, you get bonus time, which most players in the first round got a bonus time, so you get 4 minutes. Hmm. Now, I've been watching this competition on TV for years. And most of it, when you're sitting at home watching on TV, it's fun, it's diverting, it's interesting. Most of it is Chris Berman screaming, back, 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 over and over and over again. And so sometimes I watch it,
you're
sometimes
right.
I don't.
Is he still around or is he retired?
He is still around. Oh. Listen, they're gonna have to,
I
don't know how they're going to ever get rid of that guy. But yeah, no, he's still around. But I actually don't think he called. I haven't gotten a chance to watch all of the Derby. But when I checked in on it, because I did record it, because,
sure,
you know, that's what you like to do. You like to go to a sporting event and then go home and watch it. I don't think he was announcing it. But anyway, on TV, it's one to watch it in person. Now, here's another bonus for you. This is at Coors Field, which is at altitude. Which, as you know, the ball, everything travels, the air is thinner, so things travel faster. If you're a golfer, you can hit the golf ball farther. In baseball, you can hit a baseball farther. And they haven't, the Rockies do something where they keep balls in a humidor, so they don't travel as far, where they didn't do that. So the home runs that were being hit, where, Andrew, we figured it out.
They travel an average of 13% further,
yes,
which is an entire 60 feet. Now, keep in mind, they didn't have the Home Run Derby last year because of COVID.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
So this was extra special and just extra excitement because, you know, things are getting back to normal.
Yeah, and we had the stadium was jam-packed. Nobody was wearing masks.
Oh,
it was a beautiful
nice
thing. And when these guys hit the ball, to be there in person and to see the flight of the ball, I mean, it's just majestic. Coming off the bats, the hardest to hit ball flew 520 feet. You had Trevor Story there for the Rockies. He hit the ball 518 feet. I think these were records, right, Andrew?
Well, and they were records for the stadium, but, I mean, 60 feet further,
yes,
than the 2019 Home Run Derby. Now, you know the 520-footer hit a guy in the head.
What? Did it really?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, because guy was sitting so far away, he thought he had no idea that he was in the danger zone.
Well, and they were going so fast and furious that literally you'd watch the flight of the ball and you'd want to see it land.
Uh-huh.
But by the time it landed, there's another pitch and he's hitting another one already.
And that's it. Absolutely. Yeah. And that was...
It was a show.
It was a show.
And that was it. If you wanted to watch where the one ball landed, you wouldn't see the next one.
Yeah, you wouldn't see the next one.
Yeah.
Or you have to try to pick it up in midair and where we were sitting.
You're watching
on the
professionals,
club level, you were
able the best
to.
In the world.
Yes, do what the best in the world, doing what they do best.
Yeah.
And it was
in a perfect
amazing
environment where the balls can really sail.
In a perfect
sail
environment.
That's cool.
The only thing that would have been better, as Andrew said, well, do they use aluminum bats? I said, no, they might actually kill a person.
Bats. You know, like the guy who got hit in the ball, he's like, and he's okay.
He didn't get hit in the, where
in
did
the
he
head
get hit?
He got hit in the head, yeah. Yeah. So
he got hit,
you know,
with the ball.
You know, so but his quote is it's like he got struck by a bolt of lightning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah, you gotta pay attention.
Wow.
But the thing is, these balls are going so far, and to see these guys hit the ball, it was majestic. Absolutely majestic. A great time. We went, of course, when you go there, we want to get some kind of a souvenir from the ballpark. So we went to the gift shop before the Derby started. And man, let me tell you, I've never been in a gift shop that was as crowded as this one was.
Oh, I hate crowded gift shops. We've been in a lot of the NBA
was,
always has a crowded gift shop.
The Nugget shop, yeah.
Nugget shop is always packed.
Insane. And this was, we were on the club level. So,
oh, wow.
I'm sorry, we were on the...
And so
on the club level.
That's right.
Wow, I don't know if I've ever been in a club level at that stadium.
So we actually saw the parade of mascots.
Ooh, yeah,
oh,
we did.
Oh,
yeah,
I we love did. Mascots.
The eight mascots representing the eight different teams came by. I gave the Oriole bird a nice high five.
Oh, you did?
And I fumbled for my camera. And after the first two went by, I started recording. So I got a nice recording of all of them go by. And they all go by. They walk past. Very crowded concourse. Uh-huh. And I take my phone down and go to review the video. And, well, gee, wouldn't you know it, I did not hit the actual record.
Because you got so excited. You were so excited.
See the mascots.
You know, I do that. Like, I used to get really excited at like any type of Sylvia performance where, for whatever reason, I wanted to make sure I got it recorded.
And when you get
I would get so excited that my finger and I wouldn't get it.
I think your finger shakes or something. So maybe you do like a double tap.
You want to see it in real life.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You want to record it, but you also want to watch it in real life.
Yeah, that's funny. Been there.
So we're in
not for mascots.
So we're in this we're in this gift shop, and I mean, we're like sardines. Okay, we're jammed in there, and we're trying to. I found a hat. Andrew got a hat. We both got a hat.
And to be honest, I wasn't real happy with the selection. I mean,
no, I mean either. Yeah, I thought there'd be a much better selection.
And that's it. I was expecting that there would be
the swag.
Oh yeah, you know, and it was kind of slim pickings.
Wow,
it was. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that, you know, it was kind of not a last minute thing, but
the switch to Denver.
The switch to Denver from Atlanta. But no, they had enough time to make
it. Did it say Denver? Yeah. Well, yeah, it might have been that.
The logo's got an all-star with the mountains on it. Nice logo. Yeah. But so we got the hats, and then Andrew's like, well, I want a shirt. I said, yeah, get yourself a shirt. So again, we're all elbows right there, shoulder to shoulder with everybody, trying to work our way,
weasel
our way over to the shirt rack. And you forgot. We're in the enclosed club level where it is carpeted, it is air conditioned.
Really? It's
and
air
when
conditioned
you go to your seat,
there?
You know, you open up the door
really?
And you walk down to your seat. Yeah.
Valet bathrooms.
I have never.
Yeah, you get in a wheelbarrow, they wheel you to the
I have
the
never
urinal.
Been on the club level then at any
you
baseball.
You did when we took the tour of the stadium. You went to
I don't
the club
remember.
Level. Because you could see where the, and we got to see, it's very cool. You can look
announcers.
In the glass where the announcers sit.
I guess I do.
Yes, and where the production crew sits and as they're going, as they have all the different monitors there. But anyway, so we're in this gift shop and shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow, and Andrew works his way over to the t-shirt rack, and I'm a couple of guys behind him. I'm looking over, I'm seeing as he's, you know, you do that deal where you take the hangers and you slide the hangers over and you're looking through the different shirts. And then we see a really nice shirt. It's got sharp, it's like a gray shirt with these green sleeves. Really nice looking shirt. I say, grab it, let's go. He's like, yeah, this looks a great one. Let me get it. So we grab the shirt, we grab the hats, we go to the counter, ring them up. We're good to go. We go down, we watch the derby. A lot of fun. Now listen, the guy who hit the most home runs in a round, Pete Alonso, he hit 34 home runs over a 4-minute period.
Wow.
So what is that? That's like what? That's like a home run every 8 seconds, if I'm not mistaken. So 4 minutes, 240.
Something like that.
Yep. That's a good pitcher, though, too, don't you think?
Well, that's both. And that's the thing is, watching it on TV, you might not see it.
It's hard to tell.
But when you're there at the stadium, you can definitely tell the difference.
Yes.
In having a really good pitcher.
Yeah.
And Pete Alonso's guy had it going on even when Pete wasn't hitting, when he would, so each player
What's
gets
his name, Pete Alonso?
Pete Alonso. He
oh,
won
Alonso.
It 2 years ago as a rookie player for the Mets. And apparently he actually trains for this thing. His pitcher was still throwing into the net while Pete was resting just to keep his rhythm going. It was unbelievable.
That's cool.
And he was coming up to bat. He was dancing. He was mouthing the lyrics to the...
Oh, Pete was?
Yeah, he was.
Is he the one who had the
Flo
Rida song?
No, that was Trey Mancini. Shout out to the Oriole player. Every game does a different star. The Oriole magic. And I was... as I said to Andrew about 100 times, why didn't I wear my Oriole shirt? I wore my Rocky shirt. The Oriole player made it to the finals. But anyway, Pete Alonso ended up winning, and then we get back into if you haven't seen it yet. We go back to the light rail. We get in the light rail, and you think the gift shop was crowded. Man, when we got on that light rail, well, first of all, they don't have enough trains running, so we had to wait 15 minutes to get on the train.
They never do that time of night.
Then we're really like, it's like being right back in New York on the subway. We're crammed in there.
Yep.
finally, we get a couple stops before our stop here in Littleton, and we get a little breathing room, and Andrew starts going through the bag.
Did he get a women's shirt?
To check out.
Did you get a women's shirt?
No, he did not. No.
So okay. So I pull my jersey out.
Yeah.
For the first time, I'm actually pulling it out and looking at it.
Yeah.
And so I look at it. And you know, and it is indeed an all-star jersey.
Yes, okay. It is.
And it is a beautiful jersey.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is.
And then I see the date on there.
Oh no.
1998.
Oh my gosh.
1998 Coors Field All-Star Game.
Yeah. 1998.
It was from the last time the All-Star Game was here in Colorado.
Why are they selling this?
I have no idea. I found the one jersey
for
like 23 years ago.
I laughed so hard that people on the light rail turned around and they were like, what is so funny? What? I'm like, look at the shirt. Look at the shirt. 1990.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird.
You could have gotten that at a thrift store for like a dollar. How much did you pay for that shirt?
It's like $50.
Full market price.
Yeah.
Well, they knew what they were doing. They sandwiched it in there probably in between other shirts. They're like, well, we can unload these now, Frank.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I love the shirt, but I would have bought a second shirt had I known.
Right.
Yeah.
It was 1998. I would have bought a second shirt. Unbelievable.
You probably wouldn't have gotten the 1998 shirt.
People are going to see me wearing the shirt and be like, I was ready to wear this to Hawaii on vacation.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be like, people are going to look at that shirt like,
you're 23 years too late. Yeah.
Why is this guy wearing a shirt from 23 years ago?
Didn't they just have it? Why does it say 98?
I wasn't even in the country in that year.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But listen, if you ever get a chance, the All-Star Game comes to your city, wherever you're listening to us, you might not think this would be something you would enjoy. It is. It was a blast. It was a hell of a show, and we really had a good time. Laura, how has your week been?
It's been pretty good. I, you know, you have been driving with Sylvia for the most part.
That's right.
She's got her learner's permit. Dave has been awesome in that he is willing to take a risk and be calm, cool, and collected and sit next to her in the mm-hmm. passenger seat while she learns to drive on the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
and it's not easy. I mean, I can't tell you, my right leg from hitting an imaginary brake that doesn't exist is so sore.
I know.
After every time, I'm like, brake, 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 brake.
My like crash position is like on point right now.
Now, you're not a 10. You're a noted terrible passenger.
I'm
Andrew,
a terrible
when
passenger.
When we drive anywhere, and I'm driving, and Laura's a passenger.
It's true.
I can feel her whole body tense up. She's grabbing the railing on the right, the little, what do you call it?
I need to take Xanax or Valium into a car.
Well, and you know, Katie's a terrible passenger, but she's exactly the opposite.
She's the opposite. Oh.
Yeah, step on it. You could have made that light. I would have made that light.
Yeah,
she's
the
one
opposite.
That needs to teach the kids.
We need to switch when we drive somewhere. I will drive with Katie, and
yes.
You can drive with Laura. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not.
But I don't even drive. That's the thing. I'm not. Oh, I should. Oh, I do.
Oh. You do have a thing to share.
One last thing to share.
Dave has something to share. Andrew, we did not run out of gas on this vacation.
No, we did not run out of gas.
But no, we did not run out of gas.
Absolutely did not run out of gas. But we did have one exciting thing happen, and that is as we were driving from Washington, we just got out from the airport, and we're heading to hotel, driving a rental car. So sometimes when you drive a rental car, you're not really used to the actual car, and you're not really sure. I don't know how this car drives. Let me get used to it. Then you're driving on roads. So I'm driving along, and all of a sudden, from behind us, of course, wouldn't you know it? There we go. Yep. Once again, make time number four this year. Number four.
It's bad.
Number four after not getting pulled over for years. The fourth time this year, if you include Christmas Eve, we're going to go ahead and throw that in 2021. The fourth time, yes, a speeding ticket for, I don't know, what did the cops say I was doing?
I don't know. In your defense, the speed had just gone, or was just getting ready to go up to what you were driving. So I think you were probably anticipating, like it was going from a 45 to a 55.
Yeah, something like that.
And he got you right before it turned into the 55.
Yeah.
I don't know. It didn't feel like you were flying unnecessarily. Right. We were on a...
They do have speed traps.
Nothing there.
And the last time I got a ticket, 20-some years ago.
Okay.
Was exactly that. It's like just before you get on the on-ramp for the highway.
It's a little unfair.
Right, and the speed limit basically drops to like 25, and you're doing like 40. You know, and a few feet away, the speed limit's like 50 miles an hour.
This is one of those zones where they just know they can get
people from out of town.
And I said, I don't know the roads. And he's like, oh, okay,
no, I didn't even know.
Here's your ticket. enjoy this your donation to Washington State.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
Thrilled that he got you out from out of state too.
Yep. All right. Sorry for interrupting.
So it's okay. So Sylvia a couple months ago got her nose pierced, which is a story in itself. We went to a tattoo parlor to do it, which is, you know, what you're supposed to do, I suppose.
Yeah.
And this tattoo parlor, so she wanted to get a ring, so she had a stud. And so then she wanted to get a ring, and Dave can tell a stressful story perhaps next time.
I will save that story about putting
the stupid ring in.
I will save that story.
Whatever, she couldn't get it in. Dave can tell you that. And I had to take her to the tattoo parlor to get the ring properly put into her nose. So I said, why don't you drive? It'll be good practice.
Mm-hmm.
So got in, but this tattoo parlor is... It's on Broadway, which is a four-lane road.
Very busy road.
And it's in a house. And there's a driveway that you have to turn into.
And I
noticed...
Which
is very weird.
When we went back to it today. When we went back to it, yes.
It's hard to find.
It is very strange because there are houses that have been turned into businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of signs for all the different businesses. And it's hard to tell where it is. There is one lane in the middle. You can turn left or turn right.
She got into the middle lane.
Yeah.
And she... clearly couldn't tell which home it was.
Right, and she's been driving for maybe a month now, so she's not Mario Andretti yet.
And in retrospect, I shouldn't have had her do that. As we're sitting in the middle lane facing oncoming traffic, I realized, I shouldn't have done this.
Car's going 45, 50 miles an hour.
And it cleared.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, you can go.
Uh-huh.
And she proceeds to do like a farmer's turn into the house, basically. I said, whoa, stop. Because there was no driveway where she was turning. And so she ended up like T-boned with the sidewalk.
Like the curb?
Yes.
Right in the middle of where cars are coming?
Sitting. We would have gotten T-boned by cars approaching us.
Oh,
I look
man.
To my right, yeah. which is where cars are approaching,
right.
And there's cars starting to come up Broadway.
Oh,
and so I'm clutching.
Oh, no.
I'm doing all kinds of horrible moves on my part as a passenger.
Yeah.
She's not as freaked out as she should have been, but I was the one facing down death on my
side
of the car.
Right, you were looking at the...
And I said...
the Grim Reaper.
Put it in reverse. Let's go. So she puts it in reverse. Again,
oh, no.
Calm,
taking her time.
Slow.
Sure. Yeah.
I said, okay, but drive forward, because I'm trying to get my body out of Broadway.
Yeah.
And so she like carefully pulls forward, but she doesn't turn it sharp or do anything.
Oh, man.
So we end up catty corner wedged with the butt of the car hanging out into the traffic. And instead of cars like seeing like, oh, it's a student driver.
Right.
They just go around us.
Okay.
Like
yeah,
fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. People just flooding. And there was never a break. So we sat there. There would start to be a break. And this is what I realized too, as a beginner driver, you're not real fast on the reverse, like you and I and Andrew.
No, it takes you time to find where the R.
We'd hit reverse, we'd back up,
yeah,
we'd pull forward,
boom.
No problem.
Right.
She is like, reverse.
Where is
okay.
it?
Okay. And so by the time she would be ready to back up, there'd be cars coming again because of how long it took her. And it was a dangerous situation, so I couldn't have her get out of her seat. Like, you can't get out of the car in a situation like that either, because there's cars everywhere.
And she's probably stressed out because you're freaking out.
I was freaking out.
Sure.
I mean, we
it's
had...
It's hard not to.
I had sweat pouring.
I had the flop
stress,
sweat.
I had flop sweat pouring down. So we finally get in, but we sat there for what felt like 15 minutes, and my face was red, like flushed with like fear, embarrassment, upset. And we pull into the back of this tattoo parlor and we just like sit there for a second in silence. We just sit there and we don't say anything to each other.
Oh.
And she said, I think you should drive out of here. And I said, yeah, I'll drive. And she said, and I want daddy to sit next to me from now on. I don't want you sitting next to me.
Oh, really?
And I said, that's fair.
And I think that is fair.
Yeah. And we go inside and there's two like young guys all tatted up with piercings and everything. And they had seen the student driver and everything. And I said, oh, did you, because they were commenting on it. And I said, oh, did you see us out front? And he's like, no. He said, did you guys have an issue? He said, it is tricky to get in here. Yeah, and that made Sylvia feel better. Mm. And I was like, oh, there was an issue.
An issue.
It was rough. Mm-hmm. It was rough.
Well, it's hard to get used to the fact that here's your daughter who, when you look at her, you still see like a little girl, and now she's behind the wheel of a car.
It's not even that. I'm a terrible, I have really bad anxiety.
Well, you just have the anxiety. That's what I see, but you just have horrible anxiety.
Yeah, to me, it's not even that. It's the horrible anxiety that I have. Yeah.
I'm like the guy in that commercial. You remember that commercial where she's heading off in the car, and he turns and he looks at her, and she's not 16 anymore. She's like a little girl.
Oh, I don't have that.
Commercial gets me every time.
Oh, now you're going to get me. I don't have that feeling at all. Yeah. I have the, I must assume the crash position.
I see.
Yeah.
Assume crash position.
You've had some family fun with summer camp, I think.
Oh, yeah. So I think we had to title this episode the classic Rites of Passage.
That's true.
That's a good one.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we got baseball.
We do. Yep.
We've got, you know.
Driving, learning how to drive.
Teaching your kids to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my case... So my boys have been going to summer camp for 3 years now.
Yes.
And so my 12-year-old went for a month. My 9-year-old went for 2 weeks. And those boys go to the same summer camp, this beautiful Western summer camp where they ride horses and go tubing and climb 14ers. really an amazing experience. So anyways. Mm-hmm.
Did they do a 14er?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dashiell climbed a 14er.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and Dashiell's response to that was, I'll never do that again.
That was Sylvia's response. She's like, I will never do that again.
They started at like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's rough.
So, in any case, Dashiell went for 2 weeks and then Peter went. And Peter was regretting not going for the whole month.
Right? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so he was, because with COVID, a lot of the day camps and stuff just don't exist right now.
Mm-mm. Well, trust us, when we are getting ready to fly out to Indiana tomorrow, because that was the closest place we could find.
Yeah, she went to an awesome band camp, a sleepover band camp in 2019.
Canceled that this year. Last year and this year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a tough year. So anyway, so Peter finally goes to camp. And of course, you know, like Dashiell's gone for 2 weeks. We still haven't gotten a letter, right? We see photos of him every once in a while. But
I do have audio from Dashiell.
Yeah, and that is about right.
Yeah.
And so anyways, so for Peter.
Uh-oh. Big sneeze.
Yeah. So Peter, basically, we get the letter. And the letter is a card that we had like pre-written where all he has to do is write the content. And he crosses out the smiley face on the outside of the card, draws a big frown. And this is the saddest letter. Mom, Dad, I know I said I hated it here last year and want to come home. Well, this year I really mean it. I'll do chores. I'll clean my room.
What?
I'll clean the basement.
Oh, no.
You know, I really want to go home. And you get this letter and you're like, man, you just want to jump in the car.
Oh, man.
You know, and just go get that kid.
Oh, that just hurts.
It also, because Katie put a picture up on Instagram.
Yeah.
It said, please help me.
Oh, yeah.
Right, yeah. On the front.
And that, I was like, me. Andrew, Katie, if you need me to drive down, I'll go get him. Like, that hurt to see that.
And that card is obviously all emotion.
It was very emotional.
And, I think there's ups and downs.
It was very, I feel like he drew a heart. Please help me.
Yeah. So we reach out and the camp counselors, they reach out and talk to him. And,
yeah.
You know, and he's doing okay. And we actually did get
a
letter.
Did you get to talk to him in person?
You can't do that. And so,
they don't want the kids.
And that's because they might cry.
Yeah. Well, lots of different reasons. There's lots of different reasons.
Yeah.
And so, but we did get another letter from say, Mom, Dad, I'm having fun now. Please ignore the other card.
I'm forced to write this under gunpoint.
There is an archery. I'm at the range right now. They got a bow and arrow to my head. But don't worry, I'm having a blast.
But you know, it's like the old song.
Hello, mother. Hello, father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and the kid's miserable. Everybody's dying. You know, come and get me.
Yes.
And next thing you know, the sun comes out. They're all playing. Mm. And, you know, it's all a distant memory. But it really is one of those things that... It's just a typical experience with summer camp, right? That the kids
just go through that transition.
Mm-hmm. Question. When Katie, I assume she got the mail and you didn't.
Yeah, Katie got the mail.
When she got that, did she call you like immediately? Did she call the camp? What was her move?
She sent me, you know, a picture of it.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm the one, you know, I'm the one basically who reacts to stuff. Katie's like, you know.
He'll be fine.
You know, he'll be fine. And I'm the one that's
healthy.
Like.
That's healthy on her part. I would have started crying and I would have been like the car. Like, I'm driving down to the Springs. The
coming to get you.
Well, that's, and that's pretty much me.
That's not helpful. Yeah. I know that. Yeah.
Andrew was telling me he was carrying around a picture of it in his wallet. Staring at it. Is that true?
I mean,
what's
it's,
that?
They're like a Peter's card.
Well, I mean, it's on my phone.
Yeah.
You know.
It's hard. It's hard. You want to like protect them from that stuff.
Well, I mean, and
you shouldn't.
If the kid's really
you shouldn't
that miserable, and you just think he's like that all the time. But again, it's just one of those things with camp that it's the transition.
You go through it.
The kids get. But the kids always had a great time at camp. They're ready to go back to next year.
That's great.
We had them put it in writing.
good idea.
But you know, it's just honestly, it's just like that song. Just captures it, just so well that the kids just have these shifts in terms of and especially with electronics these days, going to these camp experiences, right? It's even more important than it was, you know, a century ago when we
completely
did it.
Agree
absolutely.
With you.
Absolutely,
completely agree with you.
Well, I'm glad to hear they've had a change of heart and they're ready to go back next year.
Poor
and
Peter,
it's definitely a good thing. You
I got told that Dave, I said writing. Dave, he is so special. If those kids are mistreating him,
and he is a really sweet kid, and you know, you hate to see him write something like that. Please help me,
rip my heart
you know,
out.
What do you need
you?
To get him some kind of like a. Some kind of camp where they have animatronics there.
I was thinking that too. Like a robotics or something.
Well, no, they would. And they actually do have like electronics camps here in Denver, but they're not overnight.
They're day camps.
They're not.
But again, with COVID.
They don't have them, do they?
You know, they just canceled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we couldn't, I guess. No. I mean, we looked and looked, had trouble finding one.
Had trouble. That's why we're heading to Indiana.
Sure. Go back to Indiana.
Back to Indiana. All right. Well, let's get to it. Our guest this week is Grady Hendricks. His new book is called The Final Girl Support Group. Laura and I both read this book. I really enjoyed it. Andrew, do you have any idea what a final girl is?
Is that the girl you marry?
Okay. No. A final girl is the girl who is the last one standing in a horror movie.
Like a slasher film.
Okay.
Yeah. Like when the credits start to roll, she's the one, she's defeated the monster, and she's the last one who's left.
So it is the girl I married.
There you go.
There you go. <That's right.
laughs> So obviously, if there's anybody out there who needs a support group, it's a final girl. In this book, there are a number of them. They're inspired by the final girls from horror movies. In this book, you have the girl, but what Grady Hendricks has done is very clever. He's renamed the movies. I won't go into all of them, but like for instance, you've got the girl from in the book. It's called Panhandle Meat Hook. Andrew, you want to guess what movie that is? Think slasher movies, horror classic
70s.
Horror movies.
You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
There you go. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Indeed. Give you a ding for that one. So you got the girl from Panhandle Meat Hook. And then there's the girl, I'll give you one more, the girl from Deadly Dreams. This is another slasher franchise. Deadly
Franchise was popular when I was in high
Dreams,
school.
Yes.
I almost want to think of like I forget what it is, but it's like in the swamp or something like that. In the Carolina Coast. What is that one called?
I'm so sorry. I don't know what that is. No, you got the guy, he wears the fedora, he's got the fingernails, he's got the...
Oh, Freddy Krueger, yeah.
Yes, Nightmare on Elm Street. So you've got all those, and he has a lot of fun with them. And in fact, you'll hear in our chat with him, he tells you how he picks the names. And man, does he have a great story about the girl from the Friday the 13th series. You're going to want to hear that. So this is the book that shows you what happens to these final girls when the movie's over, and now they have to live with what they've done. And well, not the movie, but to them, it's their real life, right? And it gives you the down and dirty on what they're left to deal with. On top of that, it seems that somebody is going around trying to murder these final girls, makes it all that more exciting. This book is tense. It is very real. You know, this is not like the slasher movies where the murder is almost kind of played for fun. You sit around waiting. This is like real life
and what these girls have to face is danger. It is called the Final Girl Support Group, and here is our conversation with Grady Hendricks.
I thought I would half expect you to show up with like a Jason hockey mask. Where's the hockey mask? Come on.
I know. I'm a constant disappointment. I wanted to stay on brand as disappointing.
Well, you know, there is something, the beauty in the room we won't speak of, though. We saw your
I was reading your bio. Your author bio.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've actually got a filter on that sort of downgrades me from a smart hard 10 to like a 7.5.
Just to make us feel comfortable. I like that.
Let's go 7.75. Come on.
I don't want people to feel uncomfortable around me. It's awkward.
It's wise. Yeah.
It's a great idea. Grady, we are massive fans of yours. Love your books.
Thanks.
Yeah. I've read almost all your books, but big fans.
Thank you.
We're really excited to have you on. And congratulations on getting the TV rights sold to your new book, Final Girl Support Group. Have you started the script? Are you working, Grady? What's going
on? No, I'm not. The only one I'm involved with is I'm doing the screenplay for Horror Store for New Republic.
I saw that.
Which I'm really angry at whatever this hack writer is who wrote the book, because they did not know what they were doing and have made my job infinitely harder.
That bastard.
I love that book so much.
Damn him. Right now I hate that book because I'm like, why did I do it that way? What? No, this is difficult. Where are y'all, by the way?
We're in Denver.
Denver, Colorado, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, y'all are in the stomping ground for my buddy Stephen Graham Jones, who...
Yeah. His new book is so good.
Would have wore a Jason mask for this interview.
Really? Oh, we got to get him. All right, listen, can you give me his number so we...
No, if you ever... I think you probably... Do you have my email?
No. I guess it's on your website. Yeah.
It's on my website, but Grady at GradyHendricks.com. Drop me a line. I'll put you in touch with Steven. He's great.
Really?
Oh, wow.
That would be awesome. That would be great. But you're great, Grady. So we're just glad to have you. Yeah. The great Grady.
He subverted it to a different writer there. You're doing.
Yeah. I know, right? Deflecting.
Yeah. Deflecting once again. Disappointing and deflecting.
It's fun. Disappointing and deflecting. Well, it's funny, I have this thing, and I think a lot of writers do, where you start, especially if you write a book, you start noticing that you reuse some words a ridiculous amount of times.
Yeah.
And you really start to get annoyed by it. And the one I always use too much is just. Talking about it. I was doing a workshop and my sister enrolled in it, which was, I shouldn't have let her do that. And I said, someone asked about words, using the same word. And I said, oh yeah, it happens to everyone. Mine is just, I don't know why. And it's, it's just that, just here I go. It's, you just latch onto a word and you go.
Yeah.
And my sister says, well, actually that's usually a word used by people who have imposter syndrome and feel like they aren't justified to be doing what they're doing. Oh. And it's a minimizer and it means you have low self-esteem. And I was like, thanks.
Thanks, sis.
Appreciate it.
I have heard
any
that.
Other. Contribute to the class more, please.
Oh, please. I'm so glad you're here.
But you're in Manhattan, aren't you?
Yeah. In my stinky little office, which I was actually really lucky last year because this is about three blocks from my house. And I rent an office space. Like on that side is like a driving school. On the other side, it's like a medical billing place. Like this is pretty working. It's not like a writer's space. And during the pandemic, my wife and I live in like a one bedroom apart. It's like 700 square feet.
Right.
But this place is three blocks from my house. And I was able to just walk over here every day. The security guard told me two other people in this 18 story building.
Wow.
And it was really nice to it gave me something to hold on to. Just my schedule didn't change. I just kept working. It was so, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't had that to rely on.
Normalcy.
Yeah.
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 Yeah,
some normalcy.
Yeah, especially in that city. That was that city got really. You guys got really hit by that early.
Yeah,
awful.
There was 3 weeks when in like April where it was just sirens all day, all night, and it was so disheartening. And it was strange writing Final Girls because I'd written this book before and sold it before the pandemic, and then I always knew what the last two paragraphs of the book were, but I didn't know how to get, I got there, but it wasn't right. I knew it wasn't right. I was faking it, just faking it. And so I suddenly realized what the ending had to be. And around that same time, it was August of last year, I flew down to South Carolina. It was very weird to get on a plane, but my mom got super sick. I had to go take care of her. And so it was during that second wave of the pandemic, and I was sitting in this guest bedroom for about 2 weeks, just writing the end of that book. And, you know, Lynette, the main character in the book, is she's an agoraphobe, right? She locks herself up away from the world. She's scared of people. She's scared of everything. Right. And that was us last year, you know, locked up in our apartment, scared. Anyone could kill you, you know, like you didn't know if they had COVID-19. And it was so healthy for me mentally to sort of go from writing Lynette as this paranoid shut-in to sort of getting her to a better place. It was like this book was the book I needed to be working on during the pandemic. And I was lucky that way, you know?
Yeah, I can see that about, especially about her and that little apartment too.
Yeah. Well, we love the book, The Final Girl Support Group, a story about a support group for survivors, women upon whom these slasher films have been based on. They're older now and seemingly being stalked and systematically killed. Grady, this is postmodern slasher horror with a nice Ed Begley Jr. reference that I slapped my knee at. So thank you for that. I was, you know, and I didn't realize because I Googled it that he's actually appeared in some slasher films. Ed Begley Jr.
Oh, which one? Knows? I didn't know that.
You know, I just Googled it this morning.
No worries. I was, you know, I did that because I was once at a BEA, like a big book convention, and I had a signing at the booth, and I was really excited because there was a huge line, and I was like, yes, all these people for me, I'm winning. And it turns out they were all there for the booth next to mine, which was Ed Begley Jr. and he'd had a book about biodiesel, and I was like, God damn you, Ed Begley Jr. So I held on to that for many years till I could get revenge.
So let's see, Dead of Night, 1977. Ed Begley was
starred
in that.
Him, yeah.
And Transylvania 65,000.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And Cat People. Cat People. You're probably a big Cat
People. Oh, the remake of Cat People.
Who knows?
Yeah.
1982. Is that a remake?
Yeah. That's
I've never seen it.
That's the one Paul Schrader did, I think, with Isabella Gianni, I think, is in it.
Oh, right. Paul. Yeah. I guess Ed Begley Sr. would have been in the
the original.
Ed Begley always pissed me off because I remember he hosted Saturday. I'm sorry to go off on a tangent, but he hosted Saturday Night Live once. And they had his name on the screen and said, Ed Begley Jr. He said, I'm here to announce I'm formally dropping the Jr. And did a little movement with his hand and the Jr. dropped and it was just Ed Begley. And I was a little kid. I was like, wow, he's just Ed Begley. And then he just kept on going being Ed Begley Jr.
It's funny. As a junior myself, it is a thing. It's a very Oedipal moment when you drop that junior, you know?
Don't use a junior.
I just always feel like being junior makes you sound like a serial killer a little, you know? Like,
yeah, it's the Southern style serial killer. Yeah.
Also, I had a cousin. We referred to as Billy Jr., who lived with his mom all his life. And he was Billy Jr. until he died at like 78 years old. And he's a grown man, and we're calling the name of an 11-year-old child. It was bizarre. I did not want to get stuck in that trap.
No. Good plan. No. But anyway, let's get back to your book, The Final Girl Support Group. Grady, what was it that really inspired you to write this book? A lot of late nights sitting around watching slasher movies. What do you got?
Well, this book has a really weird story behind it, because usually it takes me about a year to write a book. And this one, I think the first document I saw, like I went back and looked, was dated like January 9th, 2014. And I had tried to sell this book as my book after my best friend's exorcism. And my publisher just wasn't interested. But I sent the manuscript to him. And he was like, it was the same week that Riley Sager's book, Final Girls, got announced. Right. My publisher was like, I'm not going to read your manuscript. No, it's a hard no. I was like, damn it. And so then I tried again 2 years later. And he's like, nope, still a hard no. Not interested in the subject.
Damn.
I was like, damn it. And I shelved it. And my manager, who does all my LA work, was like, you write slow. Do you have anything I can sell? And I'm like, well, I got this sitting around, but I don't think it's very good. It's been rejected twice. And he loved it. And so I started rewriting it. And I'm actually glad it was rejected, because I sort of, it wasn't the book it needed to be until now. Right. And it took me kind of that long to get my head around it. So I'm grateful to that publisher for dropping it. Yeah. So, but there's also a weirder story behind this book. Do y'all mind a tangent here?
Oh, no. Please. We're all about tangents. In fact, we could do a tangent about tangents later on.
So when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to see R-rated movies. So I would read like the Marvel, the Mad Magazine parodies of them and pretend I'd seen them, which was a dangerous road to go.
At least you weren't reading the Cracked magazine parodies. <Yeah. laughs>
And then I was in Cub Scouts, and after Cub Scouts, we go get snacks at the Oasis gas station, and I convinced my scoutmaster that my parents would allow me to buy magazines with my snack money because, you know, reading is good, and I bought an issue of Fangoria that had, it was April 1981, and it was the issue with Friday the 13th Part 2 on the cover. And a whole feature in it dedicated to the beginning of that movie, where Adrian King, the final girl from the first movie, opens up the fridge. She's hanging out in her house, you know, getting over the traumatic events from Friday the 13th Part 1, opens the fridge, and Ms. Voorhees' head is in there, and Jason jumps up and stabs her in the head with an ice pick. So I was like blown away by how cruel that was, and how casual that this woman had survived all this stuff in the first movie.
Right.
And just gets bumped off in the first 10 minutes of the second. And it always stuck in my head, like, I'd like to give her a happier ending. And that's kind of where this book came from. And so when I finished the book, my friend Ted Gagan, who I've done a couple of movies with, he knows Adrian, and he gave me her email address, and I got in touch and sent her the book. And I named a character in the book, Adrian, after her. And I sent her the book, and she loved it. And she called me on the phone and told me this story. So when they were making Friday the 13th Part 2, they called her to see if she'd be in it. And she was like, sure. And she said, you know, I'm having some stuff in my personal life we'll have to work around, but yeah, I'd love to do it. I love doing Part 1. And so they bring her to set, and she thinks it's the first day of production. She thinks she's the lead. And what she doesn't know is it's the last day of production. And they just feed her lines as she goes. She improvises the phone call with her mom. And she doesn't know she's going to get killed until the stuntman playing Jason sinks the ice pick into her head. And you actually see it in the movie. Like, usually Friday films, they kind of like linger over the gore. Right. And there is one quick shot of her with the ice pick in the side of her head. Real quick, all done. You don't see her again. And you can tell it's the one shot they got.
Wow.
And she didn't know what was happening. And then they put her in a car, took her back to her hotel, dropped her off. Nothing.
Oh my God.
And what she hadn't told them is the personal issue going on in her life was she was being stalked really seriously. Like a guy who was like taking pictures of her in public and sending them to her house. And she got to the point where she installed a lock on the inside of her bathroom door because it was the only way she felt safe enough to take a shower. And she was telling me that there was something about the book that really was good for her to go back and revisit that kind of time in her life and just sort of put a bow on it. And so she actually wound up doing, we had to jump through some hoops, but we got her to narrate the audiobook for Final Days.
Oh, that's awesome.
And she does a killer job. And there's just this weird,
I see what you did there,
of the circle for this
killer job.
You know, this like 8-year-old kid in a gas station reading about this woman being knocked off in this movie and kind of getting to bring it full circle 40 years later to actually, you know, do something that was a nice moment for her. And some work. Yeah. Actors like work.
Yeah. That's true.
It was this weird. Yeah. It was this weird closing of the circle that actually really meant a lot to me. Yeah. You know,
that's so awesome.
Sounds like such a traumatic event for her, though. Like just on many different levels. Just embarrassing and traumatic and. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and embarrassing. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. There's something humiliating
about
humiliating.
That. It's like, humiliating.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting with a lot of these women who play final girls. There is that parallel. The characters they play in the movies are someone who does something when they're a teenager, has something happen to them when they're a teenager, and then it kind of haunts them and they have to live with it for the rest of their life, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these women have stalkers or really serious fans who feel like they owe them something and feel an ownership of the character's way. But also it helps their careers and it kind of gives them this status and gives them a living. And it's a really complicated relationship they have. And it's very similar with the characters in the movies, you know, they play who have these traumatic events happen when they're childhood and fall through the book and the characters in the book, you know.
Oh
So it's a really weird parallel there, you know, between the actors playing the characters and the characters they play.
I bet. Yeah. And, you know, Final Girl films, I think they were born in the 70s. And, you know, they're not what I would call like feminist films. But, you know, they arrived along with 70s women's liberation movement, the women's lib movement. And do you think at all they were a reflection of their time or reflection or reaction at all from the male gaze to, was it at all related at all, or is it just kind of coincidental?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because there is a tendency to, you know, horror movies to kill women.
Yeah.
And yet here you have these horror movies that are founded on this trope of the final girl and her survival and her sort of, and so, but it's actually, I think it's a real deep-seated cultural thing. I mean, that goes back to the story of Red Riding Hood. It goes back to the story of Bluebeard. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Like these women confronting someone who's, and usually a dude, who significantly overpowers them physically and outmatches them physically. Mm. And somehow either through wile or just sheer determination, somehow defeating them. I think that's a really resonant cultural story.
Yeah.
But it's actually interesting you say that about feminism in the 70s. So I was just rewatching this weekend with a bunch of people, Slumber Party Massacre, which is directed by a woman and written by Rita Mae Brown, the really famous feminist author.
Oh, yeah.
And, it is fascinating. I mean, it is a movie you watch with a six pack, but the women in it really do come across as real people. It's a girls' basketball team. They aren't talking about boys all the time. They have sexuality. They sort of own their sexuality. They care about each other. They have each other's backs. And there's a lot of really, really funny sort of phallic imagery in the movie. Like the killer uses a big drill and, you know, they frame it always so it's between his legs and stuff. It's a wild movie.
Wow.
It's, if anyone's watching a movie with a friend, I highly recommend Slumber Party Massacre.
Did you watch any other, like, obviously, yeah, I'm sure you're a big slasher film fan, I'm guessing, but do you have like a favorite franchise? What did you go deep in your slasher movie watching for this book?
I sort of did it afterwards. Like, these movies are kind of in my DNA. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, I usually do like a one-person show instead of a book event, like an author event. So I do a show that I'm starting this week virtually and in person. It's basically the history of sort of murder books and murder movies and slasher movies, because it goes way back and they're wild. And we talk a lot about primal hamster trauma and all kinds of stuff. But so I was rewatching the franchises for that. And I love them all, but it's really interesting how distinct they are from each other. I think Friday is probably my favorite because Halloween is the franchise where you feel like they're just like, no jokes, no sense of humor.
Right.
These are grim movies. And then the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, like, they're really over the top and super campy. And Fridays, I think, kind of hit in a nice place right in the middle. And it has Friday the 13th Part 2, which is a legitimately good, horrifying movie.
Yeah, I remember that one growing up. That was a good one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for Baghead Jason, you know, not hockey ass Jason. But in terms of favorite slasher, it's Black Christmas, hands down. From the director of Porky's and A Christmas Story.
Wow.
You know, it's 74, so it's early. And it's set in a college dorm during or a sorority house during Christmas. So it's all like cozy and Christmassy. It has a genuinely terrifying killer who, like, you barely see. You just see his like eye looking through a crack behind a door, or him yelling at people on the phone. Olivia Hussey's the final girl and her sweaters are on point. Like, it's fantastic. Okay. Margot Kidder's the alcoholic best friend.
Oh,
and
wow.
I want to get drunk with Margot Kidder, man. You know, it's a legitimately great film. I love it so much.
Oh, that's awesome.
Huh, that sounds great. Now, you mentioned in the book murderabilia,
oh,
if I can say it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so my favorite example that you mentioned is the gravel from where Bonnie and Clyde were shot. Do you, Grady Hendrix, do you have any murderabilia?
I do not. I find it way too creepy and suspect. I don't know why you'd want to have that in your house. And, like, listen, I'm a dude who wrote Paperbacks from Hell, so I am surrounded by thousands of mass market horror paperbacks from the 70s, 80s. I am in a glass house. I am not throwing stones at someone else's collection. But it's not a collecting type that I would be big on.
And I do love that
stuff
bookie.
Must smell.
Yeah, that one, that's true. It would.
There's some bad karma there, too. Something not good's going to happen to you if you do
but
that.
But you mentioned mini coffee table book. If I can I call it a coffee? I didn't know if I can call it a coffee table book. Paperbacks from Hell. You know, you must have been a guy who read a hell of a lot of horror growing up. How did that book come about? And did you actually read all those books you mentioned in Paperbacks from Hell? And why wasn't there more Richard Layman? As a Richard Layman fan, why wasn't there not more Richard Layman representation? Grady Hendrix, come on, man.
Oh, man. So I get more criticism about having very little Richard Layman in there. That, like, yeah, Richard Layman fans is a powerful lobby.
Yeah, we are. Yes, we are.
Well, you know, so that... That book, I did read everything in that book. I read about 326 books to write that one. Wow. And I've read a lot more since. Because when I used to be a film critic, early on in my career, I made a mistake in an article based on my ignorance about one of the movies in a retrospective. And I determined then and there I would never write about something if I hadn't read it start to finish or seen it from beginning to end. It's just, it's too easy to fake it and get wrong. And so I actually didn't read that much horror growing up because the covers grossed me out. Like, they really scared me. And but as I got older and I was writing horror, I always loved horror. Like, I mean, you know, like Stephen King and of course, and watching horror movies with my friends and everything. And as I started to write horror, I was reading a lot more horror. And I started noticing that the bookstores I really love, which are like paperback swap shops, you know, the people, ones where like grandmoms go in with shopping bags full of romance novels.
I worked at, that was my first job, was at the paperback rack. Yeah. And it was, the romance was everywhere. Yeah.
I've got to ask you though, like, did that make you love books or hate books? Was it just which?
I loved it so much. I loved it so much.
I've always wondered.
Yeah. But I was 15 and just seeing other people, even though romance wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I discovered just some great authors that I'd never, I read Vonnegut then and just all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Well, and the thing that those stores have that most bookstores, modern bookstores, don't have so much, or like new bookstores don't have so much, they always have a Western section.
Yeah.
And they always have a giant horror section. Yeah. And I was noticing, I didn't know the books. I didn't know the authors. I was like, who the hell is Barry Wood? Why are there 70 copies of The Tribe sitting here, you know? And so I started to read them and I started to write about them for this site called Tor. And it's part of the publishing company Tor. And they were really fun. And I was just randomly reading them. And my editor at Quirk, who rejected this book, he was like, look, do you ever want to pitch a book about these books based on these articles you're writing? Like, I'm not sure we'd buy it, but I think it sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Wrote the pitch, sold it to him. And it was between books on my contract. So I had 10 months to basically read 326 books and write this book. And I had Will Erickson, this guy who runs a blog called Too Much Horror Fiction, sort of co-authoring and helping me because he was the only person I could find who knew this stuff. And so that was really helpful. But man, I was really burning the candle at all five ends.
Wow. I can't imagine reading that much of that type of work.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. The thing that made it work or possible is I'd stick to one genre. So like I'd read like medical thrillers.
Oh, just like how you have it set up in the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what would happen is you can go pretty fast because, okay, here's the first surgery. And now, okay, here's the part where the guy who works at the hospital knows what's going on, says they're going to tell the main character what's going to happen. And here's the part where they show up dead and it's a suicide, but the main character thinks it's not. And oh, wait, no, they didn't do that there. Okay, I need to slow down here because they're doing something different. Okay, now we're back. Like, you just got to learn the tropes. You can really read fast on these books. Like,
that is true.
You know, I don't need to read every line of a phone call between this guy and his mom recapping the book that they put in to get the book up to 300 pages.
That is so true. And then when they do something different, though, it's so delightful to see, like, oh, wow, this is so different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just read this book, you know, for doing this book about this show about murder books called On My Honor. And it looks like it's going to be a Boy Scout slasher on the cover. But it turns out to be a really, really wonderfully well-written book about a dude who, like, he's a scoutmaster, and you think he's like molesting the scouts because they're always coming to his tents and he's talking about grooming them and all this stuff. Then it turns out that he's a hitman who pulls off these really complicated hits using hypnotized Boy Scouts. So he's got all these hypnotized 11-year-olds running around killing people. And the problem with this It's so good. And the problem with this book is it's 400 and something pages long. And I would say 60% of that is padding. Yeah. And there is, at one point, a Boy Scout pushes someone in front of a commuter train. And there are, I do not joke, 12 pages on the history of the strange station before you get to the murder.
Wow.
Yeah, it is wild. I mean, this guy's editor must have been like, it must be this many pages or you don't get paid, Malachi Black.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Maybe his uncle was a, you know, a station engineer or something. Who knows? I don't know.
Well, you know, maybe, yeah, like he's just wild about trains. Well, it's funny. I was just reading this series of books, these really wild books about, you know, that sort of heroic character you see a lot in like serial killer books, like the medical examiner who's like, I speak for the dead. Yes. I will examine the clues. There's this guy, Robert Walker, wrote four of these, and they are great because they're terrible. And he just makes up the forensic science. The guy's like, it's just all fabricated. He has like a nuclear reactor in his lab and he puts hair in it. And then he gets people's unique hair charts and everyone's hair chart is different. It's like your fingerprint. I have a hair chart of the potassium in your hair and I can identify a killer. He at one point gets someone to breathe on a microscope slide and then examines their breath under the slide. Gosh. That is not possible. But then suddenly
that's like Trumpian.
Wild. Yeah. And like suddenly in the third book about a guy who's a pyromaniac who uses a laser blowtorch to attack people who he believes are his reincarnated mother, all of a sudden it gets really detailed and precise and fascinating about firefighters. Oh. And like, it's all these fire scenes that are really intricately laid out. And I looked up and I'm like, this guy must know a firefighter or be a firefighter. Like, this is weird. Yeah, yeah. Just like you're saying about this guy in trains. Like, maybe like,
there's gotta be something going on. There's too much. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Literally. Now we're both, listen, Grady, I gotta tell you how much we did love your book, The Final Girl Support Club. We're also massive fans of your book, We Sold Our Souls, A Demented Faustian Tale.
Love that
and
book
heavy
so
metal
much.
Music. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah. Are you?
No, thank you so much. That book means so much to me. So when I meet people who like it, like, and a lot of people stay away because it's about heavy metal. Oh. And so when I meet people who like it, it means so thank y'all. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Loved it.
There were scenes in there, one where she's crawling flat in a cave area, I think. This is embarrassing. I evidently was holding my breath while I was reading the scene, and the scene was longer than I could hold my breath, and I didn't realize it, and I let out one of those like during it.
I take that as the best compliment I've gotten. Also, I'm a total claustrophobe, so that scene, like, that's coming from someone who's my real nightmare is to have something like that happen. I look at people going caving and I'm like, are you out of your mind?
That scene stayed with me. That was such a good book.
Yeah, so good. Are you a heavy metal? You must be a big heavy metal music fan.
I wasn't when I started writing that book, but I wanted to write about a genre of music that everyone treats as a joke.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there's something about saying you love metal that people instantly are like, oh, so you must be a moron. Like, and I found metalheads to be the sweetest, nicest, most welcoming community. I've got a stack somewhere. I don't know where it is, but like of napkins and bars and coasters and just scraps of paper. And, you know, that like you meet a metalhead and 5 minutes later, they're like, oh, you got to listen to this band and these guys. Yeah. And this is, and like, they're just we're so nice. And, so I really fell in love with metal and I listen to it now pretty religiously. Like, I really just like love it. And yeah, and that book was tough, man. That book, I was having a really rough time in my life when I wrote that book, and writing that book and getting Chris, the main character, through that book was like a real process for me that got me out of some serious depression. And so that book really means a lot to me. So it really kind of saved my life. So
very good. Well, we loved it, and we loved the Final Girl support group.
Absolutely.
We're gonna be watching some what was that, Black Christmas, was that the name of it?
Black Christmas.
We'll be checking that one out for sure. And we appreciate your time, Grady. Thanks a lot. Like I said, we're big fans. Really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thank you.
No, thanks so much for doing this, and drop me an email.
Oh, okay. I will. Thanks.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Okay. Have All a right. good one. Right. Bye.
Bye. Bye, y'all.
The Inside Flap.
All right. Yes, indeed. Thank you, Grady Hendrix. Great conversation. Such a nice guy. Really had a great time talking to him. And go check out that book, The Final Girl Support Group. All right. Let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called Gold Diggers, two separate words, by Sanjina Sathian. Hopefully I'm not butchering that.
Yeah.
I love this book so much. Read it on vacation. Read it as fast as I could, even though I tried to savor it. I just sat and read it. This is about an Indian-American second-generation family. It's a little bit coming-of-age story. It's a lot about the Indian-American immigrant experience, and it's got a healthy dose of magical realism in it, which is really unique.
Always great.
And we talked with Grady Hendrix about that, but you know, we read a lot of books, and Andrew, we all read them, and we all know there's certain tropes of, like, in my books that I read, it's a lot of cozy mysteries, and usually the unpleasant person in town is killed, and
right.
everybody's a suspect because he was going to shut down all of their coffee shops, or, you know, it's just like, it's one thing after the other that's all the same.
Yeah.
And so when you read a book that does something a little bit different, it wakes you up a little bit, and right. you're like, wow, that's exciting that they would do that. Yeah. So it's told from the point of view of the teenage son of the family. His name is Neil, and his voice is strong. It's funny, poignant. The tone in this story is outsider. Neil is someone who wants to fit in, but he doesn't. He wants to get this girl or a girl. He can't seem to get the girl, can't seem to say the right thing or do the right thing. He wants to also do the right thing for his community, make good choices, and he struggles, you know, which is all of this human and identifiable.
Yeah.
It's set in the suburbs of Atlanta in the 90s in a community made up of other Indian American immigrants and a handful of white kids they go to school with. Neil's family shares a cul-de-sac with another Indian family, and they have a girl Neil's age. Her name is Anita, and Neil's known her his whole life. He has a terrible crush on her. This is the girl that he really can't seem to impress at all. And one day he catches her with her mother ingesting a strange potion.
Ooh.
Turns out it's a magical elixir made of stolen gold. It gives the drinker power that comes from the original owner. So,
drinking,
for instance,
really?
Let's say you need to have a desire that you want to. Let's say I wanted to be a better cook.
Okay.
I might steal a piece of jewelry, gold, from Katie Dowd, who is a good cook.
Okay.
Melt it down, say the mumbo jumbo, yes. drink it, and then focus on being a better cook, being a better cook. Some of her mojo, being a better cook, comes into me. I become a better cook.
Mm.
Now, she would get a little less.
Would it, yeah, I was going to say, would it take
it takes away
from her?
From
oh,
her.
That's
but
fascinating.
It, so far in the story, not a great deal. Like, you're not necessarily, like, Katie's family might not notice it because right. she's such a good cook.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it works.
Okay.
So once Neil sees that something hinky's going on here with Anita and her mom, they bring him in on it, and life is not the same because Neil, you know, here's a kid who's an outsider. He's struggling. He's, you know, his sister's, you know, Miss Teen USA, you know, Miss Teen India, you know, all this stuff. And he's just awkward and struggling. He can't get the A's in school that his parents want him to get.
Right.
All this stuff. So he wants in on this magical elixir.
Sure.
Yeah. So this is a funny book, but it's also really poignant. And it's a little sad in that it really shows you that how hard it is to be an immigrant. Probably in any country, but just this one's from the point of view of an immigrant in our country.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to try to fit in and also retain your own culture. There's a lot of pressure that some immigrant communities put on their members that does seem unfair and tough. And the Indian community, which I hadn't really thought about it before, but they have high expectations for members
yeah,
of their, for that second generation.
Well, you got to do is look at the spelling bee.
Yes, and, you know, that's they mention this
yeah,
in the book.
Absolutely.
And you need to become a doctor or some other kind of medical profession like that. I mean, and you need to get into Harvard and the top schools.
Which we do have to give a little shout out. Did you see the girl who won the spelling bee this year?
Yeah, it was an African American.
Yes,
right?
Only the second African American ever to win it. But she also has been, she like has a bunch of what do you call it? World Guinness Book of World Records for dribbling basketballs, and was even in a commercial with with Stephen Curry. Yeah,
that's weird.
She is amazing.
This Indian community, the way that he's showing it is, there is so much pressure for memorization and perfection in everything that it's impossible to hold yourself up to that standard. Mm-hmm. It's not healthy, also, in how she shows it in the book, anyway. Like the pressures to try to get into the Stanford and the Yale and or to after this to go do a startup and make a tons of money and keep moving on up the ladder. And that's their goal. Mm. And that's part of the title Gold Digger, too. It's such a great book.
And I feel like I've always heard for years that, the Indian parents with the, when they come over and they bring their kids with them, that they expect them to do great things, and they make them work for it and work.
They
take away their personal life, their friendship, and a lot gets lost.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's really beautiful. Mm. Just know when you go into this book that there is some magical realism throughout the book. I love magical realism. I know some people don't,
Some people don't. So it sounds like
if you're cool with it, I think you'll love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool, very good. Gold Diggers, that's recommended by
Laura Medicus.
So, Laura, it's fascinating that it's almost like we pre-selected our books because you mentioned the struggle to get into colleges. Well, just happens to be what my book that I'm recommending this week is all about.
Cool. Dave Medicus. That's funny. Uh-huh. And I mentioned a school you told me about in that book.
That's right. You mentioned Stanford.
Yeah.
So my book is called Girls with Bright Futures. This is by Tracy Dobmeyer and Wendy Katzman.
Oh, two people.
Yeah. It's interesting. Two friends who wrote this one together. And it's all about the pressures of getting into, in this case, the hardest school in the country to get into. Andrew, would you like to guess what the hardest school in this country to get into is?
Is it Yeshiva in New York?
No, I don't. I've never heard of that school.
Yeah. That's like one of the most expensive schools in the country.
Well, I know. I'm not talking expense. I mean, just as far as the acceptance rate.
So like Berkeley, California or something like that.
With an acceptance rate of 3.67%, it is Stanford, the hardest school to get in.
See, I thought it was Harvard.
This country. My guess would have been Harvard, too, and it used to be Harvard, but now Stanford has exceeded that. And you better have SATs around 1420 or 1570.
Well, that's not it.
That's the tip of the iceberg. That's exactly right.
So a friend of mine whose kid just graduated high school out in California, 1600 plus SATs.
Wow.
The kid is absolutely brilliant. And he applied to Stanford, right? All these top schools. Didn't get into a single one.
Yeah.
Right.
And what I'm reading in this book is you need more than just the test scores or a good essay. You need to have let me get into this book. And it's a whole nother world.
Who the heck are they letting
in? I didn't even know existed. And this book opened my eyes. Now, this is obviously fictional, but granted, it's going to be
based on the scandals
that we've just gone through.
That's so funny. My book was a lot about that, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you guys ever, this is all about a group of girls who are getting early acceptance, going for early admission.
I did early admission.
Right. Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, did you do that?
I don't know what that is.
I didn't know what it was either. I don't remember why I did it.
I have no idea why I would have done it.
Well, apparently that's what you want to do. You want to get early acceptance in these colleges, and the competition
I was probably nervous I wouldn't get in.
Very, very.
Because I did not have high SAT scores, shocker.
So the book is about the amount of prep work that goes into getting into your college of choice. It takes place in the weeks leading up to this early acceptance deadline when you go to apply, and then it goes all the way through when we get the reveal to find out who gets in and who does not. Mm. And obviously the college we're talking about here is Stanford. So it focuses on three girls who are going to this fancy Elliott Bay Academy in Seattle is the high school. They are vigorously jostling to get into to Stanford, right? Now, they get some bad news. They find out that Stanford, which usually accepts like, you know, 5 or 6 kids every year from this fancy elite prep school, well, they're only going to be taking one additional student. They got like 5 athletes in. They got the athletes in. So, you know, a good way to get into college, I guess, be a good athlete. But they're only taking one more student, and you've got these 3 girls and the parents, even more so than the girls, who really are fighting for that one spot. You have a tech mogul, Alicia. Now, she's the CEO, and we're talking to parents here. She's the CEO of her tech firm, who will stop at nothing to make sure her daughter gets into Stanford. In fact, she's already donated $15 million to the school, and she considers the spot pretty much a lock for her daughter. And you got mother of 3, Kelly. She spends thousands of dollars on tutors and test prep services that she really can't afford as she fights for her daughter and spends hours just kind of, and a funny thing is these parents, they hang around the school and the college admissions counseling center trying to find out who else is applying for Stanford.
This is awful.
And, you know, they're bringing cookies and treats just to the counselors,
wow.
You know, and trying to get a phone call to the school. And then finally, there's Marin. Now, Marin is actually Alicia's personal assistant. She has a mysterious backstory that is hidden out throughout the book, but we really don't know what's going on with her. We do know her daughter is also desperate to get into Stanford, which could spell disaster for Marin, who would certainly lose her job if her daughter gets in instead of Alicia's. Hmm. I could not stop reading this book. This is a page-turner. It has been described as Desperate Housewives meets Big Little Lies, and I find that completely accurate. These mothers, apart from Marin, and Marin is our kind of our moral compass in this book, the mothers are shown to be absolutely ruthless and will stop at nothing to see that their daughters get in. In fact, the MacGuffin that gets the story going is when Marin's daughter, she gets run over riding her scooter back after babysitting.
Whoa.
Somebody actually runs her over, and the speculation is it could be the parents of someone else.
She okay?
Who's trying to? Well, you have to read the book and find out. Now, as a drama teacher, I loved all the drama you get. Yes, spoiler alert. Yes,
okay.
The girl.
Be worrying about her all night.
As a drama teacher, I loved all the drama you get in this book. The backstabbing, gossip mongering, rumor spreading, all done in a juicy manner with a dark humor. And then suddenly in Act 4, we find out something about one of the main characters, and it takes really an unexpected turn. As I'm reading this book on the plane coming back from Washington, I really was just sobbing uncontrollably. I had my mask on, and my nose starts running underneath my mask.
I didn't know this.
And then I literally, I wasn't letting it
know. You weren't advertising it.
I was not, no.
You were in an aisle seat, too.
I was in the aisle seat. I was slumped down low. My nose was running so bad because I was crying that I literally had to use the mask as a Kleenex.
Oh, God.
No.
Yes. Now, I had a couple of spare masks, and I ended up using those spare masks. Thankfully,
you want to know something funny?
What's that?
I also cried in the plane because I had a sad book.
Oh.
Wouldn't it have been funny if poor Sylvia was bookended by
was
crying parents?
Yeah, she was.
Poor Sylvia.
This book is like watching a sporting event and wondering who's going to win, who will walk away with the prize of the Stanford admission. So, so good. Run out and grab this one. I loved it. This is Girls with Bright Futures by Tracy Dobmeyer and Wendy Katzman. That's recommended by me.
Dave Medicus.
Andrew
Dowd.
So my book was not a tearjerker.
And your books never seem to be a tearjerker. Do you ever mist up while reading your books, Andrew? Because I'm always,
I feel occasionally, but not often. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So this book is called The Tracker. It is by Andrew Saxon.
Oh, we've seen that name before.
Yep. And it is a distant future space opera. And this book concerns, or the main character is Zero. And, you know, he has overbearing parents that are trying to get him into the university of the future.
Really?
No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, we could have gone 3 for 3.
Yeah. So Zero is a bit of an anti-hero, right? And this is a great...
Zero the anti-hero.
Mm. And so he is an only child. And so what happens is his parents are traveling the galaxy. And this takes... It's 100,000 years in the future. There are 10,000 inhabited planets, right, in this universe. there are aliens, right? There's a few alien species, and you know, for the most part, you know, the humans get along with the aliens, but it is a tense, you know, relationship and balance in the universe where war could break out, you know, a war that would destroy like all of humanity could break out any time. And so Zero's parents are traveling around, and so there is a kind of like a Fantastic Four-like experience, and his mom doesn't actually know that she's pregnant, but she's pregnant, and so the fetus basically gets exposed to this Fantastic Four-like radiation. Okay. And so before Z is born, they find out that, you know, he has a birth defect. And the mom's like, well, you know, I'm going to have him, and we'll just deal with it. Mm-hmm. Right, but and they don't know what the birth defect is going to be. It's like his brain is different, and so he's born and he has relatively a normal childhood until he discovers that he has some, you know, kind of superpowers.
Yes.
Yep. And so, you know, one of the superpowers is his dad has a business dealing, and his dad's supposedly good friend is trying to convince his dad that, hey, I've got this deal of a lifetime. You need to take your entire savings and invest in it. And so his dad comes home and says, well, mom, you know, we need to clean out the savings and we need to invest in this. And so...
Because that always works.
And, you know, yeah. and mom's like, well, you know, Z is really good at reading people. You should take him with you to meet this investor. Mm-hmm. And so he goes and Z basically says, dad, he's hiding something. He's doing this only for himself. So one of his superpowers is he can kind of tell what the person's intent is.
Oh, okay.
And so, of course, in this first business dealing, it turns out that this guy is about to lose his shirt, and he's trying to sell his investment to a supposedly best friend so that he doesn't lose a fortune.
Okay.
So thanks to Z, his parents, you know...
Don't go forward with
they
that.
Don't go forward, and they keep their life savings. Now, another business opportunity comes up. And, of course, this is the mom.
You could have used this guy when you sold your Apple stock.
Yeah, or GameStop stock. You know,
list goes on.
And so the mom has a business deal. And so she has Z basically read the guy and realizes that this is a real investment opportunity. And so the mom is like, well, not only we're not just going to invest what the guy's asking. We're going to give him more.
Oh.
And so they do. And so it turns out that they strike it big with this investment and they end up becoming, you know, billionaires.
Okay.
Wow.
Right. And so, you know, this is one of his superpowers is he can really read people's intent. The other superpower comes in later where there's a girl who has lost, her mom has given her this heirloom piece of jewelry and she loses it. She comes to school and it's one of Z's friends, and she's like completely distraught because she's lost this heirloom piece of jewelry. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, well, can you show me a picture of it? And so she shows them a picture of what she lost. And so immediately Z realizes he can tell the direction it's in, right? He doesn't instantly know where it is, but he knows the direction it is. And he finds he also has a drive in that he's compelled to find it.
Huh.
And he also
gets... The tracker.
And he gets,
oh, it's called The Tracker.
The book is called The Tracker. There you go.
Look at that. You figured it out.
Yeah. And so, these aren't like crazy superpowers.
They're cool, though.
They're handy.
Yeah.
They're very handy.
Yeah. So your book where you called it, realistic magic, or what do you call it?
Magical realism.
Yeah. And this is kind of like...
Realistic magic.
You know...
I like that.
Telepathic realism, I guess you can call it. Yeah. And so, what he finds is... And he ends up developing a career tracking things because he can tell no matter how far away they are, he can tell the direction. And so his parents end up being something so wealthy that they end up getting kidnapped. They end up dying in this kidnapping attempt.
Oh, boy.
And so he ends up being an orphan, and he ends up being... he is extremely wealthy because he also is a scientist, and he invents a few things. So he is extremely wealthy, but he has this talent, and he is the tracker. And so, you've got this universe that is on the brink of, you know, complete annihilation of humanity, and you've got this person that's a tracker. And so one of the other alien civilizations, a princess, is kidnapped. And so they reluctantly come to the tracker because they don't trust humans. But, you know, Zero is above board. He especially does not like people who are kidnapped or, you know, or get kidnapped because of the way he lost his parents, right? So that's one of the things is he really likes to help in kidnapping situations because he feels like he's doing something his parents would approve of, and he has the satisfaction of, right, of saving these people. And so he's a bit of a, you know, a mercenary, but kind of like a you know, I guess you would call it a good Samaritan mercenary.
Mercenary and, with a heart of gold.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he ends up developing relationships with probably the highest ranking people in this entire galaxy. And he ends up really making a difference. So he's an anti-hero, but he is a good guy. He does the right thing. You know, and he has this, like we say, this telepathic realism in terms of that. And so he goes on adventure after adventure. There is some technology involved, human technology, technology from other civilizations. There's a bit of mystery. There's some twists in this book. There is a bit of romance in this book. But, and you know, and there's at least two books in the series, because I've already read the second book.
The Twist.
Which is Tracker 2.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But the book is The Tracker by Andrew Saxon.
All right. And that's recommended by
Andrew Dowd,
which can only mean one thing, and that is it is time for the
Audiobook of the Week,
which this week, it's a good one. It is called The Stranger in the Mirror. This is a novel by Liv Constantine, and it is narrated by Suzanne Elise Freeman, Maggie Meg Reed, and Jeremy Arthur. So this book is a delectable twist of a tale that will have your head spinning. Man, this book is so good. Now, listen, oftentimes what I will do is what I like to do. There are many places I like to listen to my audiobook. I spent all day up on scaffolding today, or actually up and down the scaffolding listening to an audiobook. This one, as I'm driving around town, you know, schlepping Sylvia off to many, many different places, I'll have the audiobook, you know, playing when I go to pick her up. Sometimes I'll, you know, if she's quiet sitting there, sometimes she's on her phone, whatever, I'll let the audiobook keep playing.
Oh, that's this one.
Right. Oh. So I kept this one playing, and she kind of got, and I thought she was just looking at her phone. When we get home, she's like, what's that book? it's The Stranger in the Mirror. I said, oh, that's a good book. I like that story. I didn't think anything of it. And then the next day, when I took her, you know, over to the park, put the book on. I said, "Oh, okay, sure, I'll put the book on." So from that moment on, she's like, "Okay, you can't listen to this book without me. We're going to listen to this book together." And we had some great bonding time together.
At one point, I got in the car with you two.
Yeah, you did.
And the audiobook was going.
Yeah.
And they had it at 1.5 times speed.
Well, that's the way you got to listen to a book.
And it sounded like I was getting in the car with two crazy people.
That 1.5 times.
And then she walked down the hallway.
That's nothing.
Oh, it was insane. It was absolutely insane.
No. But it's a great book to listen to. You know, Sylvia's 15. So there was one little sex scene that I was not going to. Oh. They started to get into it. I'm like, nope. click the little fast forward button right past that little scene. But other than that, we enjoyed listening together. So this book is about a woman named Addison. Now, Addison is about to get married to her fiancé. But the only problem is she's not feeling, something feels a little bit off. And the reason is because she has no idea who she really is. Because a few years prior to this, a truck driver picked her up on the side of the road in New Jersey where she was injured and had no idea who she was or how she got there. She was suffering from amnesia. So meanwhile, the scene shifts and we cut to just outside Boston where a guy named Julian, he sits with his young daughter and they are together wondering if they will ever see his wife, the girl's mother, ever again. And that's where the story takes off. If you think you know where the story is going to go from here, take my word for it.
You are wrong. This book had so many different twists to it and so many... oh, man, listen. At one point, I actually had to go to my dentist because I cracked a tooth. My jaw hit the floor so hard that I actually cracked a tooth and I had to go get that taken care of. There was a lot of twists and turns to be had.
The twist.
Because, you know, as Jack Black, well, this gives me a chance to play
this. The cracking the tooth thing is a little much. Andrew and I just gave each other a look.
Well, listen,
it's good enough that your 15-year-old refused to let you listen to it without her because she had to listen to it. Yeah,
that's a good point. I really loved this book. I'm not going to give away a whole lot, but if you're someone out there who enjoys psychological thrillers with twists in them, dark ones, this is a really good one. So, so good. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is The Stranger in the Mirror by Liv Constantine.
Patrick lifts his glass toward us both. To Addie and Gabriel, long life. My eyes scan the restaurant and land on Darcy. Her glass is lifted, but her smile seems forced, and her eyes are sad. We all raise our glasses and sip. Gabriel's sister, Haley, is my maid of honor, but she cannot regale the crowd with stories of our shared past because, like Gabriel, she's only known me for 6 months. Despite the festive mood around me, darkness descends again, and I feel hollow.
All right, there you go. That
at normal speed.
Your, yes.
Audiobook.
Well, listen, when you listen to as many books as I do, I mean, think about it. When you read, you're not reading at normal speed.
That's true.
So what's the fastest you will listen to an
audiobook? Yeah, that's a great question, Andrew.
Well, you know, usually I'm at 1.4 is usually what my go-to. Sometimes you will get 8. Now, I don't want to give it away, but there is an audiobook I recommended. The author talked.
The author read it?
The narrator talked. So 2 times. I had to put it on 2x speed and it sounded normal.
Yeah. Wow.
But usually it's 1.4.
Do you do that, Andrew? I know you sometimes listen.
I do, and that's typically where I'll go is 1.4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
funny.
But you know, and it's you know, it really does, and that's the problem is
you're reading faster in your head.
Well, yeah. Maybe there's that, but it's some of these narrators, it's just super slow.
I honestly feel like they're trained to talk a little bit slower for people. I really do, because they seem to talk slower.
I guess that would drive me nuts. It's weird when you aren't used to it and you go and listen to what someone's listening to.
Right.
Then all of a sudden they're just listening to something that talks like this. And you're like, honestly, nuts.
It sounds completely normal to me.
But then once I sat in the car with you guys and you didn't slow it down for me.
No.
I got used to it a little bit. But it was still like kind of annoying to me. Huh.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what's not annoying, and that is Grady Hendrix. We thank him for coming onto the show. Really, really one of our favorite guests ever. Thanks so much to Grady Hendrix. Check out his book, The Final Girl Support Group. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next time.
Adios.
A lot of parents pack up their troubles and send them off to summer camp. Raymond Duncan.
Right on.
Valet bathrooms.